Right, so these are the questions we thought we would look at, covering the first three chapters. And it's quite an amazing document, really, Conquest of Bread. The first one is looking at, well, how, in fact, did he critique capitalism? That leads very nicely to really critique of capitalism, why it's relevant today, because I think there's many parallels of what's going on, where his critique is very apt indeed. Another key issue is that he makes some assumptions about all the riches that are available to ensure well-being for all. So we can talk a little bit about that, but also discuss to what extent we might need to revise this given the current ecological crisis or not. How do his views, and this sort of question before this follows on quite nicely, how does his views on unnecessary labor and wasted production and consumption relate to today? Another very pertinent issue. Then he goes on to talk about sort of the way forward, and expropriation is a key word here. And he talks about the revolution. And of course, as we know today, many people don't really like to talk about revolution. They talk about systemic change or various things like that. But what he does say is it's really only after the overthrow of the current regime that the real work of revolution can begin. So what does this work consist of? And leading on from that, as we're preparing for a revolution, are there things we could be doing now so that we might have started the work of the revolution? And in his last chapter, he actually defines anarchist communism, and he also differentiates that from collectivism. So, and also in that chapter, he goes on to give some supporting arguments for why anarchist communism is possible. And another thing he mentions is a synthesis, anarchist communism, a synthesis of two ideals, economic and political liberty. What does that mean? And then he also goes on to talk about the state and the problem of working, maintaining a state. And he talks a little bit about what it should be replaced with. So obviously, if there's other things that sort of come to mind, but this at least provides some kind of structure for a discussion. And it goes logically through the text. We hadn't really decided that. But anyway, so the first questions where we're looking at is really his critique of capitalism and how this is still relevant today. So anyone want to kick off on that one?
I'll just say something which is, it kind of goes back to point three. I mean, one of the things he points out is that we all produce this generational wealth that has come through all of our ancestors, and it's all been produced for our benefit, and we're all inheritors of it. There are no self-made men. We're all society-made men, women, etc. And so, as thus, you know, none of us can claim that we've amassed this wealth of our own, efforts. And so we all have a certain entitlement to it, you know, the universal provision of what we need. You know, we don't ask to be born, but the people who bring us into this world, you know, the people who, you know, the forces, the civilization that we're part of, been made by people who've been passed, you know, they've been made by people who are who are no longer here, as well as people who are here who are creating that wealth, whilst the criticism is that other people are taking the larger share of this pie, but we're the ones making the pie.
What I found interesting about it is that it doesn't just talk about capitalism per se, it talks about pre-capitalist societies, and I think that's really important. It talks about a succession of efforts by human beings to combine, whether it's over agriculture and the combination between medieval cities and the problems of how they integrate with an agricultural peasantry and things like that. And that there's continual efforts to make this succeed. They all fail, but out of this comes this education, if you like, that's almost there before capitalism. I mean, we get used to, you know, the world starts with the Industrial Revolution, and it's very clear that that's not so. I just found that a very interesting starting point. And he does point to certain partial successes of people combining, working together, realizing mutual aid, and things like that. they all failed eventually, but he does mark out some essentials there.
I think you're right. It kind of blows the myth of the entrepreneur, all this, you know, rubbish, whether it's you know, populist stuff like Dragon's Den or the stuff, you know, around it's capitalists taking the risk. It's therefore they deserve their fortunes and so on. I think that's dead right. And I think, yeah, he was in so many ways, the, you know, Kropotkin, what he says, or a lot of what he said, was really prescient. I think the other thing about capitalism, his critique of it, is that he draws he says very clearly that in some basic ways, it's no different from feudalism insofar as the worker or person is producing wealth. Under feudalism, someone working on the field might have to give X amount of their crop to the lord, to the feudal lord. It's no different under capitalism. In fact, in sort of some ways, it's worse because they don't even, they might retain even less of the value that they produce. And I think that's really kind of spot on and interesting as well.
For example, in relation to who owns the stuff, he says the few. And I think that's really, it's really simple. And it's really simple language. And it's like stuff that anyone can understand. And it's why I like Kropotkin. It's because he writes really simply. And I think it would be impossible to misunderstand what he's writing. And I wondered what people thought about the idea that Kropotkin wrote this in French. Which is, of course, not his native language, which is Russian. And I wonder if that improves it.
The thing with French, though, was it was the language of the Tsarist court, of the aristocracy. And he did actually come from the aristocracy. So he would have been fluent in French and Russian. Yes, I agree. It's very straightforward language. That's what I like about it. I was very pleased to read it again after a long time. And it actually sort of re-inspired me. And I thought, you know, I've been knocking about in this tin pot movement for many years. And that's sort of reconnected me as to why I'm fucking still doing it. you know, and the idea is clearly put in simple terms. And, you know, what it basically says is, well, anarchist communism is common sense. Unfortunately, there's not a lot of that about at the moment. I did notice again, though, was his optimism. I think that's mm-hmm. a mark, really sort of expansive optimism, if you like. And I think that's because of the period he was living in, you know, the Victorian age. I think in general, you know, you look at Marx, look at Darwin, all of that. You know, they're talking about progress. There's somehow this idea that things are going to progress. Things are going to get better. And as we now know, they haven't. In some ways, they've got a lot worse if you look at the environmental crisis, which they didn't really, not many people were thinking about that at the time. Perhaps, you know, another anarchist communist, to a certain extent Kropotkin, but more so another anarchist communist like Elisée Reclus, that they were the only ones who talked about nature at all.
If I could butt in as chair here to take us back to the question of critique of capitalism, I thought that one quote that I really liked that I think is very relevant today said, all our production tends in a wrong direction. Enterprise takes no thought of the needs of the community. Its only aim is to increase the gains of the speculator. Hence the constant fluctuations of trade, the periodical industrial crises, each of which throws scores of thousands of workers on the street. And I know that Marx was known for his analysis of the crisis of capitalism and the falling rate of profit and overproduction and underconsumption and all that. But I mean, I just thought in very simple terms that Kropotkin was getting to the essence of our critique and what the kind of things we're bringing up at the moment. You know, we're just seeing the absurdity of what's, you know, with price increases and people aren't able to afford. And he also mentions that workers cannot purchase the wealth they create with their wages. So this is another problem of capitalism, is that, and it's happening at the moment, that all these price increases, well, we're not going to be able to afford all the products that are being produced. So therefore, I mean, there's going to be a decline in demand, and which, of course, will facilitate, will contribute to more of a capitalist crisis. So I just thought, you know, a few things he managed to say very succinctly about the way capitalism works and how it tends towards to crises.
The other thing I think that's important he brings up, which is very relevant today, is concern with what is actually produced. And he talks about necessities. I mean, the thing is called the conquest of bread. He's talking about necessities, not the useless production of luxury items which have no particular thing. And I think that's very relevant today. If you think about the campaigns that we're trying to get going here in the Midlands against price rises and things like that, we need to concentrate against the supermarkets to get their prices of essentials down, not luxury goods and all that shit, which is irrelevant. People are already, according to the Financial Times, on strike about buying non-essential goods. Kropotkin raises this whole point about what is it that we're actually producing? If we just produce the necessities of life, everyone would have to work fewer hours. And I think that's a very attractive message.
To move on a bit, because Andrew's taken this, does anyone want to say anything more about his critique of capitalism or and how it might be relevant today? You know, what does he actually say about that? You know, about unnecessary labor, wasted production. Who are these people that we could do without?
Well, he uses a term which seemed I hadn't come across anywhere else. Puffery, which I think he's referring to all the unnecessary and useless production of stuff. Well, he refers to fashion, etc., etc. I mean, I think it's probably far worse now, because you've got a whole new number of new sectors that are involved in unnecessary work. You know, the bureaucracy, state bureaucracies have increased. Got the advertising businesses, which weren't that advanced at the time that he wrote, but quite a number of other things. So, you know, it's actually developed to a much greater extent now than it was at when he wrote it in what 1886.
I'm going along with what Nick was saying. I think that that's kind of the solution he gives. I mean, at the time in which he lived, you know, we weren't as aware of all the environmental costs of different things, but by focusing on the fact that, you know, people would produce the things that they need and wouldn't be inclined to produce the things that they didn't need because it meant additional work that they had no incentive to do to make someone else richer, it solves part of the problem by itself.
You're right in saying, but it's actually got worse because now, whereas in when Conquest of Bread was written, I guess, you know, but the mass of people were living in absolute poverty. What we have now is a situation where people might be living on poverty, but they're hoodwinked, brainwashed into thinking that they need to buy what you call puffery, you know, fashion items to be a normal person. And that, you know, that's more than I think Kropotkin was talking about. He did talk about the public being hoodwinked. He used that term, the public, but it's much wider sort of stratum of people now. If in terms of fashion, if it were a country, it would be, well, it produces 10% of carbon emissions in the world, which is an incredible, you know, incredible figure. But I suppose in terms of unnecessary production, the obvious thing as well is military production, arms, armaments, all that kind of thing. And that hasn't changed, I guess. He wrote Conquest of Bread. That unnecessary production did not take place and was used instead to meet people's needs. You know, like I think Andrew was saying, it would be necessary to have far less hours worked.
I think it's more in the thing he wrote called, what was it, Fields and Workshops? More
those
than
factories and workshops.
Yeah, yeah, but he picks up on the dependency on international trade for food supplies in particular. And that couldn't be any more relevant than it is now. You've got, you know, the Ukraine-Russian war. That's over a quarter of the world's wheat production. You know, we're going beyond nations here and self-sufficiency. You know, North Africa, the Middle East, they depend on that Russian and Ukrainian wheat, which is going to be harvested in about 6 weeks' time, or won't be harvested in about 6 weeks' time, not to mention all the vegetable oils and things like that. But it's that reliance on these long, long food chains. I know it's a fascist argument to argue for self-sufficiency in a nation's food supply. You've got to be wary of that, the security of it. But on the other hand, when we're talking about useful production, you know, why aren't we producing more of our own food? Why aren't more of us engaged in that and using reasonable technology to do that? These are all issues that Kropotkin's raising that are very relevant now.
Yeah, it seems that this is linked to the whole idea, the bit on riches, is that he did believe that there was enough to go around. So I think that links into the whole idea of, if you actually take away all the unnecessary labor and wasteful production and wasteful consumption, then in fact, you probably can produce a lot more of the things that we really need. He didn't actually, I mean, he did talk about well-being. I mean, unless someone else saw something different, I thought he sort of was a bit overly enamored with technology. And yeah, that it was this technology that was going to provide the solution to scarcity, because look what humans have done, or man has done. You know, we've created all this wonderful technology. And obviously you can't have a go at them because at the time they didn't see all the horrendous consequences. But I mean, that's something we need to address as anarchist communists. We can't ignore that. So this idea that, yes, there's enough to go around. But he also does talk about the problems of connection. And I think it's, I can't remember whether it's in the full preface or what been in the preface, but he said one of the obstacles is the fact that the urban workers seem to have lost touch with the peasants. There's sort of a disconnect with what's going on in the countryside and the cities. But he also talked about that international trade has also made a great disconnect. And he actually says that whole nations enrich themselves at the expense of others. So it is a kind of anti-imperialist critique, but that's the problem with international trade. There's this remove, you're so far removed from the people who are producing it, which is why it does seem that if we're of the way forward for us, moving on to some of the other questions about what would anarchist communism look like, I mean, it does seem with the ecological crisis and everything that we do need to do a lot more about producing locally and without saying, oh, there's not going to be any international trade now. But the Land Workers Alliance, for example, has estimated that they think if we change the food system here, so we didn't use so much land to produce crops to feed animals. I mean, most of the land in the UK, agriculture takes up 70% of the total land in the UK. And of that, the majority is either directly for livestock or indirectly for that livestock. I think the amount of fruit we produce is something like 5%. So if the Land Workers Alliance figured that if you actually changed what you produce and you actually got more of your nutrients from pulses and vegetables and things like that, that given we could actually produce for 80% of the needs. I mean, it would also mean that people wouldn't be able to have green beans from Kenya whenever they felt like it or whatever. You might say, oh, well, this is scarcity if I can't have green beans from Kenya. But I think that perhaps, you know, a new food system would be more focused on local production, and therefore bring everything closer so that we there's more connections.
I mean, I can see the real attraction of that. And I sort of grew up in an allotmenting family when I was, you know, youngster or whatever. But I can also see the great attraction if you've got a massive bread basket, which Ukraine has been for hundreds of years, hasn't it? I mean, it's,
it has, yeah.
It really has. If you've got somewhere that's really fertile that can just make enormous amounts of good quality grain, it seems a lot more sensible to have a robot, you know, looking to the future, having robot tractors going up and down, producing grain in perfect sort of plain areas, rather than having me and my 1970s allotment slaving away, which is, you know, my childhood memories, really. So, I mean, I can see, you know, it's good to have that connection. But I mean, you could all, the cancer thing would be, it's really, really, with the, you know, internet, with modern technology and everything, there's no reason people can't have that connection to the producers. So sort of if you look at the future in terms of, as a sort of technology driven, and this is what I think Kropotkin's really, from my sort of skim reading before today, was really interesting. He had that positivity about technology, you know, and he was talking about technology of the 19th century, but it would be really nice to have that positivity about technology that we have now and thinking about how some of those problems could be solved, you know, rather than looking at it in terms of a sort of allotment sort of future, looking at it in more of how we could use and harness the internet so that people have those connections between each other and between societies, which unfortunately the, you know, the war in Ukraine obviously is happening now because people have got that massive empathic relationship to what's happening there, engendered partly by, you know, BBC News and everything else. But, you know, even in terms of production and having that connection between production, it seems a lot more sensible for me to have good quality wheat coming from Ukraine and our good quality, you know, lamb coming from the hill farms of Wales or whatever. You know, setting aside sort of other issues or fruit, you know, it's crazy that, you know, we can't get, if Kent, we don't get as much good quality fruit that we can from there. But I just think, you know, if you had that positivity of Kropotkin, you could actually start looking at having those sorts of connections on a far larger scale than necessarily localism. Yeah, thank you.
Technology can be utilized. I don't know that Kropotkin, to my mind, idealized technologies is something that can be utilized. He uses the word slave, you know, like I think it's mechanical slaves or something like this, which was language that I was really surprised to read. But he was talking about transferring that burden where it was unnecessary. But of course, now we know with ecological concerns, you know, in some cases, localization would relieve some of the burden of, you know, on the environment. So it would be definitely about maintaining that imbalance, you know, and ensuring that people feel empowered in their environs, you know. So yeah, that's going to be a quandary for a future generation. But I think because, like I said earlier, because of where the emphasis is, you know, within, you know, anarchism, and because of where the priorities are, some of it solves.
Yeah, I mean, I think Kropotkin was very much a creature of his time, the time of sort of Victorian sort of belief in progress, just, you know, and in the years before the First World War, likewise, there was a, you know, great optimism in the revolutionary and labour movements. I think it's a bit more complex. I mean, certainly, technology can be utilised and should be utilised, can be sort of very useful for communities, for people in terms of reducing the amount of labour that's needed, making things a lot more efficient. But I'm not completely sold on that approach that I think you were putting forward, because I think that one of the important things around, I wouldn't call it localism, but sort of decentralized, you know, production is that it puts a lot more power into the hands of local communities, the people who produce food, the people who produce goods, in determining what's produced, how it's produced, which is, even in a very different society from the one we live in, would be much more difficult if, for example, wheat was concentrated in one part of the world, or production of something else was concentrated in another part of the world. It's probably a discussion that we can't really go into detail this evening. Certain amount of caution is needed.
Yeah, we can't be anti-technology. It's who owns that technology and what's it developed for. If it reduces back-breaking labour, then I'm all for it, you know. As Kropotkin himself says, it's a gradual development by hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of people, working people. Technology evolves like that. I just also wanted to point out this connection between the urban production, industrial production, and the countryside. I mean, if we look at the Spanish Revolution, we see a very clear link, you know, maybe, what was that, 30 years after this was written, between the labourers, certainly, and industrial centres, and the introduction of agricultural technologies to those workers allowed them to collectivise and work cooperatively, and then exchange, tractors produced in Barcelona being exchanged for food and things like that. So there's a very definite attempt, even in the difficult circumstances of a revolution and a fascist coup, to sort of bring these two things together. So it failed, but it didn't fail because of those experiments. It failed obviously because of the failure of the Spanish Republic. But you know, there's a living example of what he was talking about being attempted by the working class and the peasantry of Spain.
I mean, it's all very well said in the Ukraine. We don't know what has happened to the soil there. The monocultures can do huge amount of damage. I mean, the American Midwest has been a breadbasket, but the soil is completely depleted. And a lot of this, the Green Revolution in India has completely destroyed the soil, relied on fertilizers and everything like that. So just because something is efficient and produces a lot of something, you do have to look at the unintended consequences. And there's been some disastrous consequences from industrial agriculture. Also, in terms of labor, and this sort of links to the idea of what could you do now? Is there a way, you talked about, well, the revolutions, we're going to prepare for it now. And what he said is that one of the most important things that needs to happen when the revolution takes place is people's basic necessities need to be met. And he said, I think that you have all these politicians, you know, there's a revolution and there's a great passage in there when all the politicians are all gone to the town hall arguing amongst themselves about whose ideology is going to win over and they all want to be leaders. Meanwhile, everyone's starving. So it seems to me that one of the things now, that and it is happening, is that if we could get more and more control over food production, then we would be in a better situation to actually feed ourselves. And it's actually happening now. If you look around the country, I know people, for example, in a group called Granville Community Kitchen, and they've just managed, and they did loads and loads of, you know, cheap meals and cheap food boxes, not the sort of middle-class food boxes, but actually ones for working-class people. And they managed to get hold of some land, and they're hoping to actually directly grow food. And they've also got loads of agreements with farmers, different organic and agroecological farmers. So there's loads of links already going on where people, you know, community gardens have taken off during the pandemic, and I bet they're going to take off even more. And you mentioned allotments. I'm just reading about there was an allotment in Watford, and that went on for absolutely ages. And people were, you know, managing to really supplement their food. And the history is a working class tradition of people supplementing their poor wages by able to grow food on the allotments. And of course, what's happened today is that the state has just got rid of most of them in the name of development. And even ones that were meant to be protected, they're meant to be protected, and they weren't. So there's loads of working class people who actually look to working in the allotment as something they enjoy, not backbreaking labor. And in fact, a lot of people probably could do with a bit more physical for labor, actually, because I mean, one of the things that's called so much mental anguish, I think, is people sitting behind their computers on the internet all the time. You know, I mean, really getting out in the fresh air and working on your allotment does a lot for people's mental health, and workers have always known that. So I think that there's a lot to be said for not always thinking that technology has the solution, and you do have to look at the long-term consequences.
Yeah, and you were saying about the revolution, and I was just thinking, well, actually, one of the ways that you can cut down revolution is to isolate people. And if people are dependent on imported foods or foods from other areas in that kind of big food chain sort of agro-industry business, you can cut them off, you can starve them out. And like, if they've got no alternative, it's just like, well, and that's why I think this whole agro-industry thing is like, actually, it's kind of a capitalist thing.
Well, this whole idea of once you have the revolution, then what do you do? Which I think is a very important question. And then if people want to talk about his critique of collectivism, and also the whole, his optimism about anarchist communism is possible, his optimism. But there's also the whole thing about the state. There was quite a bit there about the problem with the state and what might be an alternative. These are some of the issues. So if anyone wants to comment on any of these or anything else you should so desire to comment on.
The thing I really struck me was he's talking about the right to well-being. He also calls it the right to live. He contrasts this with the right to work. And, you know, a lot of us remember the right to work campaign that it was the front for the Socialist Workers' Party. You know, they used to put that forward. I think they probably sort of still exists in a sort of state of suspended animation, ready to be trotted out, literally, again. It was around in Kropotkin's day, you know, this French socialist called Louis Blanc was talking about the right to work. So it's not a new slogan. But I mean, what you said was, I thought it was really struck home, you know, the right to live, the right to well-being against the right to work. You know, a revolutionary, what you saw was a revolutionary demand as opposed to a reformist demand. And he said, right to well-being means the possibility of living like human beings and bringing up children to be members of society better than ours. While the right to work only means the right to be always a wage slave, a drudge, ruled over and exploited by the middle class of the future. The right to well-being is the social revolution. The right to work means nothing but the treadmill of commercialism. So I thought that was pretty good stuff.
Rejection of syndicalism as well. Of anarcho-syndicalism, which was extremely powerful at that time, 1905, at its peak in France and in Britain as well, and in the United States. You know, that everything was just the workplace. Underneath that right to work was everything, the workplace, the revolutionary trade unions. And I read into that some kind of underlying critique of anarcho-syndicalism there.
I'm not convinced of that, because he did actually support all the moves towards anarcho-syndicalism when it emerged.
I mean, I can't speak for Kropotkin, but, you know, I think many people and many other thinkers have looked at syndicalism as a method of revolution, you know.
Yeah.
And so, I think it's not as like the ultimate ideal. I know some people do. They think that's how the ultimately society should be organized. But a lot of others have seen it as a pathway towards communism. So that's how I would understand his view. But that, as I say, he doesn't say that explicitly. It's just my opinion.
I don't know if I should return to technology, really, because it's been covered quite a bit. But and also I'm straying a bit here from Kropotkin and the Conquest of Bread. But I believe, and I haven't read the Conquest of Bread for ages myself, but I can remember some of it. And I haven't read Murray Bookchin's Post-Scarcity Anarchism really at all. But I believe that Bookchin, I think I'm right in saying, also talks a lot and puts a lot of emphasis on technology as well. sort of seen in some quarters that like Butchin sort of developed some of Kropotkin's sort of work in the conquest, but I just thought I'd mention that because I thought it was quite relevant.
Kropotkin's criticism of a right to work slogan, it ties in with what he writes about legislation as well, I think, which is in opposition to what we would call reformism. He kind of makes it very clear that it's not worthwhile sort of tinkering with the system. You need a complete replacement.
The idea that when he said, because it's, I think he's, I can't remember exact words, but he said something about, we often have this idea that the revolution is kind of the sort of set piece thing, you know, and we all work towards this moment of revolution. And then he says, then you sort of say, all right, then now what do we do? And I know we don't want a blueprint for what happens afterwards, but at the same time, if we don't at all start thinking at all of what needs doing, he doesn't really say. He says the real work of revolution can begin. And he seems to imply that what involved is production, is actually putting production under workers' control to produce, to make sure that people's necessities are met. He seems to think that's one of the first things that needs to happen, which is why I sort of referred to the fact, well, we therefore need to try to prepare people for being able to take over it and be able to take over production and be able to carry on with what we need, get rid of what we don't, transform what's there into producing new things. You know, we're all going to, people are going to need to be skilled. They're going to need to know what they're doing. And I just feel that a lot of times in the anarchist movement, I don't think I wouldn't even be capable of growing an apple or whatever. You know, I wouldn't know what to do. So it just seems to me that being a bit more practical, looking at how we could actually prepare ourselves for producing what's needed by people to live. Well, that's one big issue. And then this whole idea of, well, how are we going to divide things up? Idea of collectivism or communism, and his optimism, what evidence does he provide that it is possible? And then the whole issue of the state, these are all things that he talked about.
I guess on what you're saying about envisaging, you know, this eventual community organization, potential anarchist civilization. One thing that I think has set anarchism and anarcho-communism aside from like the scientific socialists is that we weren't shy to be a little utopian, or at least to use our imagination, you know, like starting back with William Morris, but going up to like Ursula K. Le Guin, you know, in more modern times. And some of those, I've got a bookshelf in the other room that's just full of these types of books. And in some of these authors, you look at something like Bolo Bolo or something like that, and they go into great detail of the, and they're pulling upon civilizations, organizations, you know, movements throughout history that did this in very practical ways. Now, but I can certainly sympathize. If I were to touch anything green, I'm sure it would die. So my skills will have to go elsewhere. But I guess this comes into something that Kropotkin doesn't speak about directly, but, you know, like, I mean, ideas of dual power, prefiguration, you know, those sorts of things. That's kind of where my mind goes when thinking about you know, some of these possibilities, you know, and Bonnie touched on that with, you know, with, for example, what that particular organization was doing, you know.
Yeah, I just need someone to help me refresh my memory. It's been a few years since I read the book, but I was interested in how did Kropotkin envision, like, the future society, how the communes and things are sort of organized with each other, and how they're, what's the relationship between like local level communes and regional and global communes? I mean, if he does talk about that in the book, even if someone could just remind me of a rough outline of what he says in the book.
Well, we just done the first three chapters. In the next chapters, which will be in the next part of our reading group, we're going to have a look at them.
Oh, okay. So that's later on in the book.
Yeah, it's later on.
Oh, okay. Okay. Good.
I believe so. Yeah, Andrew.
I was just on Darren's point there, he seems to have this sort of organic view that it's all different sizes. We're not talking about some kind of federalist structure or anything that organized, but all sorts of different little groups, production groups of different sizes. Some are what we could say were international, some are not, some are very local. So there's no kind of, you know, it's not like the CNT in Spain where, you know, you've got local federations and a region and then some kind of overarching body. It's not like that at all. He seems to have this very almost, as I say, organic, different things, different patterns, different groups, just learning to work with one another. That's the impression I got.
Yeah, he touches on it at the end of chapter three, but it's left, we're left a little bit sort of waiting for the answer a little bit. But I think Andrew's right in that he mentions examples of what, because the obstacle is the state. And because he thinks the state takes over. So the state takes over. And I think we saw that with some during the pandemic, because a lot of the mutual aid groups sprung up and were sort of beginning to coordinate amongst themselves as well. And people talked about how the local council sort of muscled in and started taking over some of the operations. I think they talked about that in Leicester. I don't know, Andrew, Rob mentioned that, you know, so local councils and the state wants to take over. And also once we had a speaker from Cuba a few years ago and from the Cuban Anarchist Federation. And he talked about that there was at one point almost a vacuum of power where things had sort of collapsed and hadn't sort of reformed themselves. And people, all these structures sprung up and people were beginning to organize production and they were doing quite a lot of things. And then the state reformed and they just took them over. So they just grabbed, you know, put their heavy hand on them. So, and I think he says that so the state's not there. There's all these examples of groups that are forming and beginning to coordinate with each other. And to me, this goes back to the question of what kind of things could we be doing now? And to me, it seems like one of the biggest weaknesses of the revolutionary movement is the fact that there's people are involved in so many different campaigns and there's just no links between them. So, you know, I talk about the food because recently I've been finding out a lot about the food movement. But then a lot of people involved in food, they have no links with people involved in anti-gentrification and housing struggles. So you could have in the same locality, someone's doing a housing struggle and you could have some community gardens, but they're not linking up. And or there could be other groups in that area. So I think we're faced with so many people involved in single issue campaigns and they're not making the connections between them, which means that this is what we should be looking towards. And we talked before in the ACG about the idea of a commune. You know, he does mention the commune as the sort of organ of basis of decision making. And in some ways, we should be trying to form these kind of communes. I know it's still within capitalism, so there's a great limit on what it can actually do, but at least bring together people from different struggles. So there's some kind of unity so we can be more effective than we are now.
By the commune, you mean something organised in a locality rather than some hippie commune, don't you?
Of course.
Yeah.
I can think of nothing worse as ex-Californian than the idea of a hippie commune.
Bonnie made the point that she wouldn't know how to grow an apple. And I think that's a really interesting point. When we're talking about preparations for revolution and for taking over, and about production and about work, there's this assumption that we just don't know enough about the work processes because of the way work's organized. We all do little bits. It's all broken down into pieces, even in the same factory. How are we going to run that production until we have this overview and this understanding of this overall productive process? And we need to work on that as a matter of education and preparation. You know, we need to understand what it's like inside there. We need to understand all these different jobs and how they how they can be real. In order to reorganize them, we need to understand what's going on. And we have, it's nothing to do with democratic arrangements or anything like that. It's simply understanding the process of making things or providing a service, all these different fragmented integral pieces. And we need the inside view of people engaged in those industries who will be taking them over as to how that's done. We don't have that overview of these different production processes. And I think that's a vital part of the education we should be looking for.
There was a thing back in, when was it? The 1970s, wasn't it? The Lucas Aerospace Plan.
Yeah.
When workers in aerospace industry wanted to talk about the idea of converting it into something else, something much better, and that idea is starting to that sort of workers' plans ideas are starting to be revived again, I believe.
Went to a meeting with some of those Lucas Stewarts. They had hundreds of ideas, and they did that in the opposition to the Benn and the Labour government.
He was the minister at the time, wasn't he?
Yeah, and the AUEW, their own union nationally, and they still produce these, how to turn an armaments industry into peaceful production. I think there's a booklet around detailing what they could produce, and they knew they could produce. I'd like to see much more development of things like that, personally, yeah.
Link up really in with the Lucas thing. I mean, part of it was that the theory behind it was that the workers, their skills were transferable to be making positive, useful things rather than armaments. And that was the logic behind it. And they were using their skills and knowledge to create things, you know, there was kidney machines and portable kidney machines and a road rail bus and things that they deemed to be useful, that maybe there's a connection there that we could be looking at with the whole Green New Deal business and the people that are working within the nuclear and fracking and all of those industries. It would be quite positive, just rather than say we're against it all. You know, it shouldn't happen and all this, but you know, what could you do with the skills that you've got? How it's not a question of just being all green, you know, and going into green stuff, but thinking about the skills and the knowledge that you have and how can we use that to make productive things and things that are useful and positive for society.
Do we agree that it should be that you should be able to each according to need rather than have things like labour vouchers and things like that?
Move away from the collectivism in the anarchist movement of Bakunin. And yeah, I mean, you know, sort of what's the phrase he uses? All for all, you know, basically from each according to their ability, to each according to their needs. And that to me seems like, you know, a fundamental tenet of anarchism and anarchist communism, because no way can you define what someone should get for, you know, the work that they've done. It has to be according to people's needs and according to people's abilities, which vary. You know, it's a fundamental tenet of sort of anarchist society, I think.
Yeah, and I think if you had a collectivist society where, you know, it was depending on what all the work you gave, you'd create new inequalities, which he saw immediately, and that's why he plumped for anarchist communism. He clearly saw the dangers of, you know, you get something because you work for it. It's this way, you know, it's a far more equal system that it included, you know, that gave to all for all, as you say. So that would include, you know, the aged, the infirm, youth, et cetera, and people who are involved in so-called unwaged work as well.
You've got echoes of that in the debate about universal basic income, haven't you? You've got some of those same arguments coming through. contemporary about how it really suits capitalism to have a universal basic income. You can get into that. I don't think you can be too prescriptive about it. Going back to Spain again in 1936, there were different methods in different areas. In some cases, there were voucher systems for exchange. In some cases, they kept an equal wage for everybody. You know, they each different collective was coming up with different means. And at some point, they needed to exchange with other collectives for machinery and stuff like that. And there needed to be some form of exchange at that level too. So I don't think we can be too prescriptive and ruling it out in the way that Kropotkin does. I think these societies will evolve according, they might come up with different systems all the way through. We're not looking at some basic universal wage system or anything like that, just some means of exchange. And I also think that the vast majority of people, certainly in a transitional stage, would expect some form of encouragement. They'd want everyone to pull their weight.
Onto the state a bit. He doesn't say a lot in this chapter, but he certainly does a critique of parliamentary democracy and working with politicians. That was quite strong, wasn't it?
Yeah.
You know, and well, actually, it was quite powerful the way. And he said that was the problem with the earlier socialists, is that they distrusted the masses.
Yeah.
And I thought, you know, that was a really positive point, is saying that, you know, it is going to be the working class, ordinary people who are going to make this future society. I thought to argue for that quite strongly against the, at the time, it must have been that people thought that leaders would take over and bring about socialism, which of course then what happened with Leninism. And another question I might have, I don't know if people want to talk to about it, but back to the old today's economic crisis and what he said, I'd just be interested to see what people thought about what is going to happen. Because you've got a situation where workers can't afford to buy, as Kropotkin said, what they're producing. Often what they're producing, they don't really want anyway. Like luxury yachts apparently have increased their production in Britain. It's one of the few areas of increased production. So the workers can't actually afford to buy, and even less so now that the prices are going up even more and more. So what do people think is going to happen? Because if people can't afford to buy things, they're not going to buy things. And demand goes down, and there's could be potentially a much greater crisis with people being laid off. Because that's the problem, I think, that Kropotkin said with capitalism. Until we get rid of capitalism, we're dependent on it. We're almost dependent on its success, because it's in crisis, and that's causing us problems because we can't afford stuff. But if we then ask for more wages, which I'm certainly in favor of doing, they're just going to put prices up again. So there's constantly going to be this constant struggle. There's a constant class struggle between us and them. And I think Kropotkin made that case quite clear. So really, the only solution to this constant struggle of trying to get a little bit more back from them as they grab more and more from us is the revolution.
You see, part of me, when I think about this, I start wondering about sort of how close is what we've got. I mean, at the moment, what we've got is it's almost like this sort of zombie economy, isn't it? I mean, even pre-COVID, after 2008, you know, you had just loads of companies that were just economic basket cases. I mean, a high street was economic basket. You had restaurants that were these restaurant chains that weren't making money, that were basically existing pretty much just on the hope that they'd be bought out by an investment fund or whatever. You know, I'm just thinking that, you know, you can sit, I live in East London, so you could go to Stratford Westfield and you'd sit there and you could just see business, Jamie Italian, all these businesses that just weren't making any money. Then COVID happened. The ones that hadn't folded before that suddenly got furloughed, and they managed to sort of stumble on for another year and a half. You think, I mean, even in America, how many millions of people in America had withdrawn themselves from the labour market? There was this whole issue of, in the same in Japan, you know, where you've got loads of young people who were just, they said they were like bedroom dwellers. They realized they may as well sit at home, you know, on, you know, social media or whatever. That's what I'm saying. They've withdrawn themselves from the workplace. Yes. They were living because the price of food or whatever is such a level that people could just about get a buy on, you know, on benefits or whatever. And there was this massive problem at the time is people don't really seem to want to be working. It wasn't the idea that they were doing anything productive other than that. It was they were just, you know, in this sort of weird sort of consumption zombie state. Obviously now, with the massive rise in prices of everything, all those people are being dragged into a state where, you know, people feel they have to work because otherwise, you know, you can't live in heat and everything else. But I'm just thinking, you know, there was this sort of weird state of where it didn't feel to me like capitalism, really, in the same way Kropotkin was talking about it. It just felt like you had this quantitative easing, you had this massive sort of false zombie, I call it like zombie capitalism, you know, where basically companies weren't making money, but they were still being supported by the state to keep going. But I mean, I'm sure what I've said there completely steps outside.
I think it relates because I think, you know, the question was asked, you know, like, well, what's going to happen in this situation? And then then universal basic income was brought up. And I think you have these giant corporations that feel entitled to be supported by the government. I mean, in places like America, they're pretty much paying for the politicians to be in place. You know, they're receiving subsidies or not paying taxes and getting subsidized in that way. And it's interesting that some of the leaders of some of these corporations are in favor of a universal basic income.
Yeah.
Of course, because then it's a guaranteed means, you know, to consume their products, you know. You know, the last Davos, they said, you know, I think the slogan was, you'll own nothing and you'll be happy, which is kind of like a new neo-feudalism almost. Well, I guess even the feudal peasants own, you know, had something that, you know, they gave. But the idea is that I guess we'll just live our least lives, you know, get our amount so that we can buy our toys, but, you know, not own anything substantial. Certainly not the younger generations won't own homes or anything. I'm just saying if things went on indefinitely, that would kind of be how I would see it going.
If I could just say something to what you said there, here, now. I was just wondering whether you thought, I know we were straying a little bit. It's a bit more on our public meeting we're going to have on the cost of living. But Kropotkin didn't talk about the whole issue of debt. Because isn't it, so that seems to be that it's almost, we've got this situation where people are encouraged to get into debt. So even though they're not earning the wages to buy things, they're given credit cards and urged to take out more and more loans. Or if they happen to have a mortgage, then of course having a house releases loads of credit to them. Everyone wants to lend to them because then they can go lose their house. So that's almost like, it's sort of, you're right, so this really artificial economy that's existing, that's not based on anything real, but it's people's idea that, oh yes, I have money because I own a house, or I can still consume because I've got a credit card. So I don't know what people think is going to happen. I mean, how much debt can capitalism actually allow for before it does actually come unstuck in the current situation?
Exactly. And it's that ties people in, doesn't it? Because if you suddenly think, you know, you can't think I'm just going to be, you know, not just, but whatever, growing my own food and making my own homebrew and everything else, because I've got a £80,000 debt over my head that I've got to, you know, pay off. It's a classic control mechanism, really. And then that £80,000 is suddenly a commodity which can get sold on. And yeah.
As with the student debt that's now been sold on. I can't prescribe what's going to happen. I don't think we can predict anything at all. It's really difficult to say what's going to happen next. Will there be a social revolution? At the moment, it doesn't seem likely, but we've been surprised before and we can be surprised again.
I think the other thing was about his optimism about human nature. And we've spoken a lot at schools and to A-level students, and we always get the questions about but it's not possible. People, you know, they won't be able to, you know, the human nature, et cetera, et cetera. But Kropotkin, I thought, was so optimistic that people are capable of creating anarchist communism. So I was just wondering, do people here, do you share the optimism still about, despite everything that's going on, do you share the optimism that we are, that the vast majority of human beings, despite being right-wing, despite all the things the working class does that we abhor, do we think the working class has the potential to create this new society? Do you feel optimistic?
I'm going to talk again just for the absence of that. I don't know if anybody else has read Rutger Bremen's book, I think it is, Humankind. He's an economist, I think, who very much, in fact, he wrote an article about how his book was inspired by Kropotkin. But he gives wonderful examples of times of, you know, I mean, where you think the worst of human nature is some capitalists define it, you know, as some social Darwinists define it, would come out. But people instead, you know, revert to, you know, a cooperative mode, to a communal mode, and are, you know, are capable of great things, you know, under very difficult circumstances, and how it's part of the narrative of people believe that we're just, you know, we're you know, nature red in tooth and, you know, claw, you know, it's part of their narrative that they promote the, and even slant the news and history to portray things differently. Not that people aren't capable under fear, under mental health issues of atrocity and things like this, you know, under the pressure of authority and conformance. But I think one of the points I really loved about The Conquest of Bread is that he sees it as a natural state, you know, that communism is what we are capable from in this at the start, you know, and you know, he speaks about primitive communism, you know, he speaks about these ancient examples, you know, and that was part of our that was the greatest part of our history, our human history.
I'm an optimist about it. Answer Bonnie's question. I wouldn't be an anarchist if I wasn't optimistic about it. And I guess if I was talking to a school, you know, the two classic, almost cliched examples are the lifeboat. You, even in England, let alone in the world, you can find examples. The lifeboats, which Kropotkin himself mentions, the lifeboat service, there's a blood transfusion service. These are all very altruistic, volunteer, non-state. Well, the blood transfusion service wasn't a state thing when it was first started. In fact, it was developed by Spanish Republicans. Yeah, I'm an optimist, and there's two examples you can give to the school students.
Yes, I mean, it seems very difficult some days to be optimistic, certainly about the prospect of a revolution. But likewise, I think I am an optimist, and it fits in with being an anarchist. Kropotkin, he was ever the optimist, and perhaps he took it to a bit of an extreme in some of the examples that he gives in his book. For example, he says, look, you know, even capitalists, even merchants cooperate with each other. And perhaps that wasn't the best example. But there are loads of examples, even over the last year or two. You know, I know it's become a bit of a cliche, you know, within the anarchist and, you know, socialist movements. But look at what happened during, it isn't over yet, but during the pandemic. Although some of the mutual aid groups did get co-opted or ambushed by local authorities, by councils, there was some incredibly, you know, strong cooperation and, you know, so excellent examples of mutual aid on local housing estates here in Walthamstow in East London. We, you know, we still got one, which was never taken over by the local council. So, yeah, there are grounds for optimism. And if anybody hasn't read the book that Nate mentioned, although it's not presented as an anarchist book, in essence, an argument for anarchist communism. And it's interesting because Kropotkin talks about a whole, I think he calls it a pseudoscience that has been built up to make people believe that human beings are not, you know, innately cooperative or tended towards mutual aid. And that's very prescient, because that's exactly what exists in this society. People are encouraged. I think it's one of the arguments, one of the things that is said in the Humankind book, that people are brainwashed into thinking that they are selfish and other people will be selfish, because that's exactly what the people in power want them to think, so that they can remain in power. And yeah, there's that pseudoscience still exists today, whether it's talk about the Stanford experiment of people, Stanford University, all that kind of rubbish. But in fact, there's a much greater tendency for people to cooperate and support each other.
It's the nature of Kropotkin's writing, you know, is if you're willing to be mildly optimistic about stuff and the possibilities of humanity, then Kropotkin is, you know, he kind of reinforces that big time. It's not all of Kropotkin, the book, obviously. He's multifaceted in many ways, but it's part of him, a very, very important part of him as well. So I haven't got anything profound really to say about it, but it was a massive influence on me, certainly, as a young person.